Your argument now in the case of Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation against Zenon. Mr. Johnson.
May it please the court. Together, the issues raised by Zenon and Worf's combined appeals cover about at least nine issues. Certainly, our time doesn't allow me today to address all nine issues, nor do I intend to. In my opening argument, however, I plan to try and cover 4 points if I can. I'd like to discuss Zenon's statutory right to separately license its interest in the jointly owned patent. I want to talk a little about what the evidence shows with regard to whether or not Zenon and Novartis intended for there to be a sublicense to Worf's rights in the Novartis agreement. I want to talk a little about the effect of the settlement between the University of Wisconsin and Zenon over the research that was done and whether or not the funds that were owed on the claims that Worf asserted. And finally, I just want to point out a few problems with the arguments and the citations in Worf's gray brief, which we did not have an opportunity to respond to. Taking up the first topic, Worf's brief is really full of unsupported rhetoric and invective about how Zenon deprived Worf of all benefit of the ELA, the exclusive license agreement.
I think you could probably help us, at least you could help me, by referring to the foundation as the foundation instead of Worf, who is the weapons officer on the Starship Enterprise.
I'd be glad to, Your Honor, although just so you know, that's the name they go by, that's the name by which they're commonly referred to.
They may be commonly referred to that among people who commonly refer to them,
Yeah. But
I'm not one of those people who commonly refers to them at all. And when you're dealing with a generalized court, it usually helps to use English rather than acronyms that only specialists use.
I will be glad to refer to them as the Foundation, Your Honor. So the Foundation's brief is full of rhetoric and invective about how Zenon deprived the Foundation of all benefit of the exclusive license agreement. And then there's a recitation of the many bad acts that the Foundation contends Zenon did. The Foundation's central argument and the basis for the invective in its briefs is that Zenon had no right to separately license its ownership in the joint patent application without also licensing Worf's interest. That argument runs afoul of 35 U.S.C. 262, which specifically grants us the right to separately license our interest in the joint patent application without regard and without accounting to the Foundation. Now, Worf is very sophisticated when it comes...
I guess it's hard, isn't it?
Oh, it is. I'm sorry. Because I've been doing it for years. I apologize, Your Honor. Yeah, I mean years. The Foundation is very sophisticated when it comes to licensing its patents. In fact, its only business is handling patents for the University of Wisconsin. And it was certainly aware of the statute and probably aware of this court's decision many years ago in the rail trailer case, in which this court recognized that a statutory right to separately license its interest in the joint patent application without any accounting to the co-owner is what this statute provides. So Worf knew long before the exclusive license agreement was negotiated that Zenon had this statutory right. With this knowledge, Worf then enters into license agreement that contains no limitation on that statutory right. At no time during the negotiations did the Foundation ever discuss the statutory right, much less ask Zenon to give up that right. The Foundation now seeks to rewrite the exclusive license agreement by arguing that the Foundation intended for Zenon to give up its statutory right. But nothing in the exclusive license agreement supports that argument. We talk in the brief about the Shearing case, which is a subsequent Federal Circuit case that followed this court's decision in Rail Trailer, in which it's just such an argument that an agreement waive the rights was before the court. In that court case, the Federal Circuit rejected the argument because there was no specific limitation in the agreement on the right of the statutory right of the co-owners to license separately. And why this is so important is because Xenon had this separate statutory right that Wharf was aware of, and it exercised that right, there can be nothing wrongful about not including a sublicense to Wharf's interest in the Novartis agreement, to the Foundation's interest. As the Federal Circuit said in the Shearing case, quote, the co-owner may not be prohibited from exploiting its rights in the patent, including the right to grant licenses to third parties on whatever conditions the co-owner chooses, close quote. And that's at page 344 of the opinion. Now turning to the question of whether or not a sublicense was included as a matter of the intent of the two parties to the Novartis agreement, Xenon and Novartis. Wharf goes back on, again, not to an argument about what the agreement provides. It simply says to the court, well, if you don't force them to license our interest, we lose all benefit under the agreement. That, as I will discuss briefly later, is not true. But when you look at the agreement itself, it's quite clear that no sublicense was granted. And in great part, the proof is in Wharf's own admissions in this case. Certainly, Wharf has admitted and not contested several important things. One is that Xenon has the option to sublicense. It's not required to. It's strictly an option. It's a right. And they've also admitted that Xenon is not required to enter into sublicenses with third parties. Furthermore, the exclusive license agreement between Xenon and Wharf does not require that licenses be made jointly in the name of both the Foundation and Xenon. The Foundation's made admissions proving that no sublicense was intended. For example, in their red brief, they say Xenon controlled the language and was able to call the Novartis agreement a license or a sublicense. And when you look at the agreement, you will see that Xenon and Novartis chose to call the agreement a license. They've also admitted that there's no reference to Wharf or the exclusive license agreement anywhere in the Novartis agreement. Another admission the Foundation has made is that Section 2B of the exclusive license agreement,
as I understand it, counsel, is that Xenon licensed to Novartis or passed on to Novartis what it described as every entitlement it had, which you would think is what Novartis wanted, because otherwise Xenon or the Foundation might avoid this exclusive license by licensing to somebody else. And if Xenon gave Novartis every interest it had, then it was giving Novartis whatever interest it could pass on via sublicense from the Foundation. Now, that seems to be the district court's conclusion, and that makes a good deal of sense. What's wrong with it?
First off, it's certainly true that Xenon did not grant Novartis all of its interests, nor was there any evidence of any intention. It's true that the district court's original opinion found there was an assignment, there was a transfer of all of Xenon's interests in the joint patent application. That finding was reversed on our post-trial motion. The reason was that Wharf first raised it in its reply.
Look, it doesn't make any difference when the district court did something or didn't. I'm asking a substantive question.
Yeah.
We're here. Everything has been briefed. What was briefed in the district court and when is utterly irrelevant. So if you'd address my question, I'd appreciate it.
I will. Thank you. It's also quite clear, for example, when you look at the case law as to whether or not there has been an assignment as an operational law, you will see that all...
I'm not asking about case law either. I'm asking about what inferences are properly drawn from the package of rights that Xenon licensed to Novartis.
Okay. First off, the package of rights that was licensed is defined in the agreement itself. And it was designed, and the district court properly noted that in order to make that determination, you must define what's included in Xenon's patent rights. And Xenon's patent rights, when you look at that definition, does not include licenses. It only includes patents or patent applications, not licenses. So by the terms of the agreement, there was no transfer of the license. The second thing is, wouldn't you find it unusual?
Let me ask this question in a different way. Do you think Novartis would have a legitimate grievance if the foundation licensed the same rights to one of Novartis' competitors, such as Abbott Laboratories? And Novartis turns around to Xenon and says, you gave us an exclusive license. It turns out our competitors claim to have exactly the same rights we have.
Well,
would Novartis have a grievance?
Wharf cannot, the foundation cannot do that, Your Honor, because as long as the exclusive license agreement was in effect.
No. I don't know why. On your view, if Xenon has not licensed any of the rights it got by a sublicense from the foundation, why can't the foundation license the same thing to Abbott Laboratories or Baxter? But the question I'm asking is, under the contract Xenon signed with Novartis, would Novartis have a grievance if that happened?
Well, my basic point is it can't. If they did that, it would be a breach of the exclusive license agreement.
Exactly.
And Xenon would have a right to protest that.
You're just not tackling my question. Suppose Xenon says, I am now going to use my sublicense rights under the agreement and license the very same innovations to Baxter. Would Novartis have a grievance?
No, Your Honor.
No.
Xenon, because they're not a party to the exclusive license agreement.
You're not listening to my question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
If Xenon licensed Baxter or Abbott, giving them rights, the same rights Novartis has, but this time Xenon saying, I'm now sublicensing the rights from the foundation, would Novartis have a grievance?
That's a question that hasn't come up, and
But I've just asked.
No, I'm just taking a moment.
Until
to
now,
think.
It didn't come up.
It's never come up.
Well, it just did. Isn't
it? It did. And I'm trying to. So I'm just taking a minute to think about it.
That's wise.
Yes. I believe the answer to that question, Your Honor, would be no, because again, Novartis has no rights under the exclusive license agreement.
So Xenon's position is that it's given Novartis exclusive rights, and it also has the authority to give anybody else the same rights it gave to Novartis on an exclusive basis by sublicensing the foundation's rights.
I don't believe that is correct, Your Honor.
But you just said it was correct. You just said that Novartis would not have a grievance if Xenon did just that.
Yes, but the...
Seems to me either they have a grievance or they don't.
But the reason is, the reason I don't believe the statement is correct, Your Honor, is because Xenon has not licensed the Wharf's interest, the foundation's interest, to Novartis. So the question assumed that that was in fact the case. What was licensed by Xenon to Novartis was Xenon's interest in the joint patent application. And Xenon quite clearly cannot license anybody else with that interest. And what's more, Xenon would not license it, and that is, as we've briefed, an exclusive license agreement, even though Warsh's interest is not included. And we cited the case law to that effect. The fact that there's no assignment, or excuse me, not an assignment, no sublicense of the exclusive license agreement does not mean that there is not an exclusive license. There's an exclusive license, and that exclusive license is just to Xenon's interest in the joint patent application. I hope that answered your question. And again, you know, wouldn't it be highly unusual for there to be a sublicense when there's no mention of war? With all the absences of, I think when you look at it and you look at what happened here, the record is very clear. Novartis was well aware during the due diligence of the existence of the exclusive license agreement. They never once asked that Xenon give them a sublicense to that. And when the Dr. Levin of Novartis deposition was taken and he was asked about it, he did not say that they ever asked for such a sublicense. And he indicated what Novartis was really interested in as part of this deal were the compounds that Xenon had developed and owned separately. I want to briefly cover this one point on your question because it has to do with the reversal by the district court of the finding of an assignment. Worf was going to argue that there was an assignment still because they're going to say that they said in their briefs there's no evidence to record to support their argument, however, that these other rights have no value. But the fact is that only a limited field of use was licensed by Xenon to Worf. And because Xenon retained rights, including co-promotion rights, and the right to use the patent technology in all fields other than human health care and animal care, that there was no assignment and there can be no assignment. I also want to talk briefly about the third issue, the question of the research agreement and the research that was done and then the settlement agreement between UW and Xenon. As you know, Xenon contends that Worf's claims under the Bayh-Dole Act are barred by this settlement agreement, and I believe they are. The Foundation's brief at page 10 contains a detailed recitation containing numerous assertions about Xenon's failure to pay for research done by UW. And UW had asserted all those claims, including raising the issue of whether or not federal funds would be used for research for Xenon if Xenon didn't pay certain sums they said were due and owing. After extensive negotiations, Xenon and UW settled that issue, and a written settlement agreement was signed that contained one, general releases, and two, a covenant not to sue. Thereafter, Worf sued Xenon, alleging the exact same issues that had been raised by UW and settled. Throughout this litigation, Worf repeated the same allegations that UW made during the negotiations. Now, Worf asserts that it's not bound by the settlement agreement because it wasn't a party. However, Worf's got no rights under the Bayh-Dole Act. Only the UW has those rights. All of the Worf's rights are deprived from UW, and when UW settled with us on this issue, that any claim UW had, whether they brought it directly or brought it through Worf, they released us. They gave us a general release, And then they breached that agreement. How did they breach it? How did UW breach it? Because before Wharf could bring this case, there had to occur what was called an equity review by UW. UW had to review the Wharf and tell Wharf that federal funds had been used for this research, and they did that. After having settled this very issue with us, therefore, it's our position that the filing of the complaint was a breach of the covenant not to sue in the settlement agreement. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, and given that, I'm going to shorten my presentation. I still would like to just point out a couple problems with the gray brief because we've never had a chance to address that. I can't point out every instance, but for example, in the gray brief, Wharf states, Xenon provides no authority for its narrow view of the coverage of the Bayh-Dole, namely the proposition that the statements in the federal grant applications must explicitly match the research performed by Bayh-Dole to be triggered. And they cite Xenon's yellow brief at page 47. Xenon did not make any such statement. And if you turn to the very next page, the page they didn't cite, you'll see that Xenon cited 37 CFR 401A2, which provides that, quote, an invention which is made outside of the research activities of a government-funded project is not viewed as a subject invention since it cannot be shown to have been conceived or first actually reduced to practice in performance of the project. I have other examples, but I want to reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Johnson. Ms. Noel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The District Court properly held that Xenon did not just license its undivided interest. The District Court properly, looking at the Novartis agreement and interpreting it, found that Xenon also sub-licensed the Foundation's interest in the joint patent application as well. Looking at the Novartis agreement, Xenon granted Novartis an exclusive worldwide license to Xenon technology, which includes Xenon's interest in all patent rights in the field. It's undisputed that patent rights includes the joint patent application. Thus, we look at Xenon's interest in the joint patent application. Now, notably here, Your Honors, Xenon didn't license its title in the joint patent application, nor its ownership interest, much less its undivided ownership interest, but rather used the general term, interest. So what was Xenon's interest in the joint patent application? As the District Court found, part of Xenon's interest in the joint patent application was Xenon's interest in having the right and privilege of being the only party entitled to make use of the Foundation's share of the joint patent application for commercial purposes. This amounts to an interest under anyone's definition, including Xenon's in this litigation. Xenon's Shafiq Fadai was deposed, and he testified that Xenon had an interest in the joint patent application through the exclusive license in Wharf's rights in the patents. Now, Xenon repeats over and over again, Wharf isn't mentioned in the Novartis agreement. But if you read, first of all, it's just common sense that part of, if Xenon has a monopoly on where Wharf's interest gets licensed, of course it had an interest. Moreover, Xenon warranted in the Novartis agreement that it is, quote, the owner or licensee of all rights, title, and interest in and to the Xenon patent rights and Xenon know-how licensed hereunder. That is found at JA2143. So the notion that Xenon presents to this court that Novartis knew all about the exclusive license agreement, it never asked for any interest, that's belied by the terms of the agreement itself. The District Court very properly interpreted the term interest, since it wasn't a defined term, to use its common and ordinary meaning, and that was incumbent upon her to do so under Wisconsin law. And under Black's Law Dictionary, interest means right, privilege, or immunity. Now, Your Honor, you asked the question about, well, if Novartis didn't get a sublicense under Wharf's interest, could Novartis really realistically have expected Xenon to turn around and sublicense Wharf's interest? And of course not. And using Wisconsin's contract interpretation rules, we look at what a reasonable business person would expect, especially when you look at the financial terms of the Novartis agreement. Up to $157.5 million before a single product is sold. Someone in Novartis's position, it is not plausible, could believe that Xenon gave them an exclusive worldwide license, yet that same party, Xenon, could take Wharf's interest and not just license Baxter, but license Baxter and Abbott and every other pharmaceutical company around the world. It simply does not make sense. Now, it is also Wharf's position that Xenon, in fact, could not just sublicense its interests, and for two related but distinct reasons. One, because the exclusive license agreement is, in the words of Section 262, an agreement to the contrary, but also under Wisconsin law. We had a contract, the exclusive license agreement, between the foundation and Xenon. And under that contract, there was an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. And what we've heard from Xenon throughout the litigation and here today is it had the unfettered right to park Wharf's interest on the shelf, never sublicense it, never make any products, never pay Wharf anything besides the de minimis minimum royalty, and yet it can go out and meet with Novartis and license its rights for up to $157 million in pre-commercial payments alone. When you look at the fact that the parties, the foundation and Novartis, or rather Xenon, carefully negotiated the sublicensing provisions, affording that Xenon would pay Wharf, the foundation, 7.5% of all milestones and license fees, that those provisions would be all for naught unless it was incumbent upon Xenon to commercialize this technology for the joint, for the benefit of both parties. Otherwise, why would Wharf ever enter into such an agreement? Excuse me, the foundation. Moreover, what's important here is under Xenon's interpretation, it could effectively eliminate the foundation as a licensing competitor, thereby making its ownership interest essentially an exclusive.
Well, I think it's well to be concerned about strategic behavior by Xenon, but of course the foundation is engaged in strategic behavior of its own in this litigation. The foundation claims that because it dropped a dollar of federal funds into this pot, all of the intellectual property rights came back to it, even though it had sold them for a substantial price to Xenon. And I'm wondering what it is in the Bayh-Dole Act that says that in a dispute between a university and a private party, if one federal dollar enters the picture, the university gets to go back on its contract.
And by that, Your Honor, you mean the settlement agreement or the
I'm interested in the
agreement?
Argument you're making, not independent of any settlement, that if any federal dollar got in, the Bayh-Dole Act of its own force gives all of the intellectual property rights back to the university.
Your Honor, there is the exclusive license agreement. The foundation and Xenon have an agreement of how they are going to share the profits of the intellectual property at issue. It has been the foundation's belief from day one that this was going to be a joint business enterprise, and actually it is Xenon that would get the bulk of the profits. Now, if Xenon contends that this intellectual property does not fall under the joint program and it's somehow not covered by the agreements between Xenon and the Foundation, then WARF has the right to exert its rights by virtue of the Bayh-Dole Act for ownership. But it is the Foundation's belief that the whole SCD program was governed by this cooperation, this business deal that they had struck with the exclusive license agreement and the sponsor option agreement. The research either falls under the agreements to share in this intellectual property. For example, under the sponsor option agreement, WARF takes title to it under the terms of the sponsor option agreement, and that's something Xenon read, agreed, and approved of. And then Xenon would have the right under the sponsor option agreement to license that. Also, at issue here, of course, Xenon would argue if it had an inventorship, Bayh-Dole wouldn't trump Xenon's inventorship in, for example, the PPA invention. There would be co-ownership rights.
I wish you would use English. I made this point for Mr. Johnson.
I apologize, Your Honor.
EPA.
I apologize, Your Honor.
The briefs of the two parties in this case are essentially unintelligible to a generalist. You ought to try reading it yourself. Any given paragraph is just alphabet soup. It's one acronym after another. The SCA gave the PPA to so-and-so. It's not English, and it may be fine for somebody who spends his or her life dealing with this, but I assure you, we don't spend our lives dealing with this. One of the major goals of appellate lawyers is to translate the specialist lingo to something we can understand, and neither side made the tiniest effort to do that. It was very frustrating reading your brief. So if you would translate now into English, it would help me.
Yes, Your Honor. Your points are duly taken, and we apologize. We did attempt to invest effort to make it in plain English, but we clearly failed in that regard.
Rule one is specialized acronyms are not plain English. They are just gibberish to an outsider.
Our apologies, Your Honor. What we have here in plain English, Your Honor, was a research program where researchers at the University of Wisconsin came up with some inventions and to help with human health, to potentially cure diseases such as diabetes, hypertension, deal with cholesterol, obesity. It informed Xenon of this potential discovery, and Xenon entered into agreements with the university to fund research and separately entered into agreements with the foundation to take ownership of the intellectual property. Now, if the research at issue here for inventions which the district court held on summary judgment belong only to Xenon, if they fall within the scope of the research programs, then the district court was in error because the foundation has some ownership interest in the profits from that discovery. If Xenon is correct and those discoveries it made on subsequent inventions fall outside the scope of the joint research program, then we must look to whether federal funds were used in the conception and reduction to practice of those inventions. If they were, under the mandate of the Bayh-Dole Act, the foundation would have an ownership interest.
You lose me. I've read the Bayh-Dole Act. I don't see any mandate of any kind. What I saw in the Bayh-Dole Act is a provision that a university, as between the federal government and the university, a university can elect to receive certain property interests, and if it does that, it has to meet some standards specified in 202C. I can't see any mandate for anything, and I can't see any provision in the Bayh-Dole Act that specifies ownership interests the university via some other private party. What you seem to be saying, what I read your brief to say, perhaps incorrectly given what you're saying now, is that the Bayh-Dole Act settles ownership interests not between the federal government and the university, but between the university and third parties other than the federal government. And I couldn't find that in the Bayh-Dole Act. Now, am I misunderstanding the Bayh-Dole Act, or am I misunderstanding your argument?
Worf's argument is that under the Bayh-Dole Act, if an invention is conceived and reduced to practice using federal funds, that there is an order of entities that may take title to it. And the university has a designee here, the foundation, is in line to assert title. And the Bayh-Dole Act states that if
the... the federal government.
No, Your Honor, we disagree with that.
What language in the Bayh-Dole Act are you relying on? Your brief doesn't actually cite any language from the Bayh-Dole Act.
And, Your Honor, I fear I don't have a copy in front of me here today. We'd be happy to submit that if that would benefit the court.
How can one just cite the Bayh-Dole Act, which is in the U.S. Code, runs roughly 10 pages of tiny type, and not bother citing any language? I read it as carefully as I could and found no language that would help the university.
Your Honor, in addition to the Bayh-Dole Act the rights that the foundation asserts to this, these other inventions, which the parties regretfully now, I must admit, called the PPA invention. It stands for pyridopiperazines.
Say what?
Pyridopiperazines. And amino nicotinamides.
Isn't that lovely?
Yes.
Rings on the tongue.
In addition to the Bayh-Dole Act, the foundation also asserted a contract right, and that is under the sponsor option agreement between Worf and Xenon. And under the sponsor option agreement between Worf and Xenon, the foundation and Xenon, the parties specifically agreed.
I understand your argument that they may or may not have lived up to their contractual rights. But your argument, and I wish you'd tell me whether I'm correctly understanding your brief, your argument is that, as I had read it, that the Bayh-Dole Act trumps the contract, and that it provides that the university has ownership. And that's the thing that I'm not understanding. If you look at 202C, which seemed to me the cornerstone, it said each funding agreement, and then between the federal government, and a small business firm or nonprofit organization shall contain appropriate provisions to effectuate the following. Right? So it's talking about the contents of funding agreements between the federal government and universities. It doesn't look like it is providing that contracts the university strikes with anybody else would be upset. As far as I can see, the only real issue here is of interpreting the contract, not of interpreting the Bayh-Dole Act. That's why I set off on this set of questions.
Your Honor, if I may clear up one point, the only contract that the foundation would assert that the Bayh-Dole effectively trumps, to use the court's word, is the consulting agreement between the inventor and Xenon. There is no agreement that the foundation has as between the foundation or Xenon or the university and Xenon that the foundation is asserting are trumped by virtue of the Bayh-Dole Act. And the foundation does believe that the terms of the Bayh-Dole Act give it the right to claim title as long as it meets certain requirements, such as making disclosures to the federal government. Separate and apart from the Bayh-Dole Act is the sponsor option agreement between Xenon and the foundation. And so regardless of whether any federal funds are used, if an invention is made as part of the research program defined by the various research agreements, then Xenon and the foundation agreed that the foundation would take title, and then Xenon would have an option to license that same technology. And so there was a sharing agreement, a contractual agreement in place that the foundation asserts should be upheld. What the district court did here was hold that the foundation failed on summary judgment to put forth any evidence to show that the invention at issue fell within the confines of the research program. The foundation believes that that was an error of the district court, that the foundation put forth affirmative evidence showing that under, for example, research program number 2, the goals and objectives of that research program were specifically to screen certain inhibitors, a compound that might reduce the FCD1 activity. That's a human enzyme that this whole case is about.
If I could interrupt the
yes.
specifics on that, did you ask for a trial after you lost the summary judgment motion on that point?
We just reserved our right to appeal on that issue.
Well, if you lose summary judgment, the claim goes to a trial. You're the plaintiff, right?
We are the plaintiff, yes.
So you didn't ask for a trial on that claim?
The court informed us we wouldn't have one because she entered judgment against us.
So she effectively granted summary judgment for the defendant?
That's correct, Your Honor.
On her own motion?
No. Xenon had filed a motion for summary judgment seeking the complaint to be dismissed. There were cross motions for summary judgment. The foundation...
On that specific claim?
On all claims, I believe, Your Honor.
Well, I wasn't real clear on that. That's why I'm
okay.
asking the question.
Yes, Your Honor.
So there were cross motions on all claims.
I believe that Xenon filed a motion for summary judgment to dismiss Wharf's declaratory judgment claim that it had an ownership interest in the subsequent inventions by the UW inventors. And she granted that motion. We believe that the foundation had presented affirmative evidence at the very least to avoid a motion for summary judgment dismissing the foundation's rights. The foundation believes that there was at least a question of material fact and that it had a right to a jury on that issue. And in large part, if you compare what the scope of each of the research agreements is, and in particular, I would, for an example, direct the court to research agreement number 2. It reads on exactly what the claimed extra invention that Xenon took title over with the other inventions, namely to screen compounds to see if they inhibit SCD1 or sterol CoA disaccharase and its potential health benefits impacting on cholesterol and cardiovascular disease. Those two things were hand in hand. The foundation actually believed it had the right to affirmative summary judgment on that claim. It at least raised an issue of material fact to defeat summary judgment. Your Honors, going back to Xenon's appeal, one other major issue that they raised was the issue of damages. And the foundation believes that it certainly came forward with affirmative evidence of damage to support the remitted amount. Xenon asserts that this damages award should be overturned, and in doing so, it overlooks the extremely rigid standard for a court to review a damages award on a judgment as a matter of law. Xenon seeks to re-weigh evidence throughout its briefs and offer evidence that the jury was fully entitled to disregard, and in fact makes arguments on the evidence that it never made to the jury itself. Now, the district court followed its obligations and disregarded evidence favorable to Xenon to the extent it was not offered by disinterested or credible witnesses. Mr. Levin's testimony, cited so often throughout Xenon's brief, was the 30B6 Novartis representative who testified at deposition. And important for purposes of this appeal on how to weigh that evidence, to the extent it favors Xenon, is that Xenon at the Novartis at the time had an $11 million investment in Xenon. Novartis, rather, had an $11 million investment in Xenon. So clearly, Novartis was not a disinterested witness, and the jury heard that and was fully entitled to disregard his testimony. Furthermore, Mr. Levin freely testified that he could not remember the negotiations with Xenon. So the district court, Xenon's arguing here that the foundation, rather, had to parse out each potential ill-defined piece of know-how and all the various patent applications that it licensed under the Novartis agreement. But what's important here, and the district court found important, was that Xenon failed to do so. And it didn't do so even though it was a party to the Novartis agreement, and it failed to do so even though under the exclusive license agreement, under Section 4E3, Xenon was under an obligation to provide a full accounting of what it owed Wharf, the foundation, rather. And it failed to do so. So Wisconsin law, it's very well established under the Novo Industries case that by having caused the uncertainty in proof of damages, the contract breacher is precluded from demanding a more precise measure of damages. Now, in its brief, Xenon asserts, well, Xenon did nothing wrong, so that rule doesn't apply. However, if you look to the Novo decisions, if you look to this court's decision in Olympic Hotels v. Johnson Wax, as a preliminary matter, that's not the litmus test. It's having actually had a contractual breach. Secondly, it's not the case here because Xenon was under a contractual obligation to provide an accounting. And the district court found that Xenon breached Section 4E3 in failing to do so. Xenon asserts in its brief that Section 4E3, the duty of providing an accounting, is only regards for products sold as opposed to milestones or license fees. However, if you read 4E3, it specifically provides a full accounting showing any amounts owing to Wharf, that's the word used in the contract, under Section 4B. 4B itself specifically discusses milestones and license fees. Now, the foundation did provide evidence of damages, and most notably, it provided Trial Exhibit 114, which was the sales pitch document from Xenon to Novartis, where it discussed what it was selling in terms of what intellectual property it had to offer. The one and only item of intellectual property was the joint patent application. Now, Xenon, in its appeal here, asserts, wait a minute, some of those other patent applications licensed to Novartis were actually filed after the date of Trial Exhibit 114. As a preliminary matter, that is an argument that Xenon did not argue at trial or to the jury. So it's the foundation's position it can't do so now. But more importantly, it's misleading at best. If you actually look to the evidence, there were four what Xenon and Novartis called families of patent applications. One family was the joint patent application family. Clearly that was before Exhibit 114. The second included patent applications that were filed before or claimed priority before Exhibit 114. The third had some patent applications that claimed priority before or within a month of Exhibit 114. So a reasonable inference would be that Xenon certainly knew of these intellectual property rights at the time it was shopping the joint patent application. The foundation also presented to the jury what the material claims of the joint patent application were and the descriptions that Xenon and Novartis used of the other patent families and walked through the language and showed how the joint patent application claims were dominant, and they all had priority. Now, these claims, Xenon asserts we should have had a claims construction under the Markman decision. Nothing in Markman holds that a court must construe claims unless they are confusing or there's a material dispute between the parties on them. And the Federal Circuit has reaffirmed that rule time and time again. If there was a term that Xenon thought was ambiguous that the court needed to construe, it didn't raise that argument at trial. Moreover, they did not point to a single claim in any of these other patent families that it asserted did not fall under the joint patent application. The foundation also provided evidence through Xenon's own witnesses that none of the compounds claimed were under commercial development, that any of them had been tested in human trials, so it was a reasonable inference for the jury to believe they were worthless. Finally, Worf actually presented testimony about the de minimis value of compounds. They cost about $600. So it was clearly within the jury's province to find that the true value was in the joint patent application. Once Worf put forth all of this evidence, it was incumbent upon Xenon to come forth with other evidence to argue for a reduction. It failed to do so, so the foundation respectfully requests this court deny the appeal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Noel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Mr. Johnson?
I'll be quite brief, Your Honor.
As long as the brevity is not achieved by acronyms.
You can be sure I'm going to try and stay away from those, Your Honor. I want to talk a little bit about the initial argument she made that unless the sublicense is included, Worf's left with nothing but the upfront license fee. And really, if you look at what happened here, that whole argument is standing what happened on its head. They had no option but to give us a license. Why? Because before we sponsored this research at the university, we entered into what's the sponsor option agreement, which gave us the right to a license for the research we were sponsoring and paying for. What the sponsor option agreement did, and it even contains a draft license agreement, is it gave us the option. It gave us the right to get the technology that we were paying for, and we paid $2 million in research funds to the university. And so they're saying, well, all we got was an upfront license fee. No, what the university got here and what the university wanted was sponsored research, and they got that. What's more, the university stands to benefit in the future. Xenon has retained co-promotion rights, and it's never been disputed that if and when Xenon sells products, they will get licensing fees under the agreement. That was never in dispute. So the fact is, when they say they're not going to get anything out of this, that's far from certain. On the other hand, they said we're getting a guaranteed $157 million. Well, if you go back and read that agreement, you'll see that that's certainly not true. And certainly we're not going to get $157 million before there's a single product, because there are product development goals throughout that. And every single payment in the future past this $4 million is contingent upon a number of things happening. Finally, I want to turn to this interest in the use of the dictionary definition. There was no reason to use a dictionary definition for interest. The patent rights are defined in the agreement under Xenon patent rights. She said that those rights included the exclusive license agreement. That's not the case. When you go back and read what the various definitions are in the agreement, in the Novartis agreement, you will see that licenses are never mentioned. Again, as what I said in my opening, it's only patent and patent applications, not licenses, that are included. And that definition is what's granted, and that definition governs the scope of the grants clause, and nothing was granted other than what's in that definition. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.